1960s, there isn't another member of the Boston media that's followed the Celtics more closely than Bob Ryan. Hello again, everyone. I'm Abby Chin, and welcome to another episode of the 86 Celtics Interviews. We've been bringing you extended versions of material collected for CSN's documentary on the world champion 1986 Celtics. In this episode, we hear from legendary Boston Globe beat writer, columnist, and basketball guru, Bob Ryan. To start off this podcast, Ryan talks about the state of the Celtics heading into the season following a loss to the rival Los Angeles Lakers in the 1985 NBA Finals.
By 1985, the Celtics, with Bird and Mikhail Parrish, had now won two championships and had lost a tough finals in 85 to the Lakers. First time the Lakers had beaten them in Boston. Kareem celebrated, very famously talked about how he felt like Johnny Padres, from the Dodgers in 1955, beating the Yankees and all that. And we knew they were going to be good, but there were some issues. The one reason that they had not won in 85 was Cedric Maxwell had gotten injured in the middle of the season and never got back to where he was. And for whatever reason, whether he didn't work hard enough, which some say, which he denies, of course, thoroughly, or it just didn't happen. But it didn't happen, and they needed him. They were very shy on manpower. And so, therefore, the big move going into 85-86 for personnel was the addition of Bill Walton. And they got Bill Walton by trading Maxwell to the Clippers for Walton. Now, remember, Walton at this point in time had never played more than I don't think he'd ever played 70 games. He had played, even in his MVP year of 77-78, played 65 games, which means he missed 17 games, still great enough to be MVP. And you didn't know what you were going to get. You knew that when Walton was healthy, on those rare occasions when he was healthy, you had somebody very special, but who knew what was going to happen? As it turned out, this happened to be one of the keys to the entire season, in that Bill Walton played in 80 games, the most games he ever played in any game in his NBA career, any point in his NBA career. And the two games he missed had nothing to do with his notoriously bulky lower extremities. He had a broken nose once, and I think he was sick in the other one. So he gave, and he played in every, and he made every two a day in practice, which was unheard of. It was just a blissful, magical thing for them to have happened. So they had Walton, and this gave them an edge that no team has ever had before or since. There have been many notable sixth men. Celtics, of course, pioneering with for the most part with John Havlicek and later with Mikhail. But there had never been one who was a center, who came off the bench and had the kind of impact on a game that Walton would come to have. But anyway, they needed Bill Walton. The second thing they did was pick up a guy that people in Boston had no idea who he was. And that was Jerry Seasting. But Jimmy Rogers, assistant coach, was keen on Jerry Seasting, as I recall. And this was to give him some additional scoring punch off the bench. And Jerry Seasting was, pure and simple, a professional jump shooter. That's, if you put on his income tax return, it said occupation, put professional jump shooter. That's what he did. But he had never been publicly profiled. People didn't know him outside of Indiana. He went to Purdue, played for the Pacers. You know, that was his whole world. But people knew in the league. So that was an addition, and that strengthened the bench. Now, when the season started, where they stood at that point, well, they were two-time champions. Bird was coming off a second MVP season, a back-to-back MVPs, and was worthy of winning it even earlier than that, but he won it for the first time in 1980 and 83-84. And so he's pretty much in the peak of his career. He's 29 years old. Mikhail has asserted himself. Parrish is in the peak of his career. Dennis Johnson, it's going to be year three for Dennis Johnson. The core was very good, and people knew they were going to be good regardless. But there's a difference between good, very good, and transcendent. You know, no one realized at the start of the season they were going to be one of the great NBA teams of all time, if not the best, which I believe they were. I'd put them up against anybody for any seven-game series that's ever been played. But no one saw all that coming. That was to be determined.
Early on in the season, it was apparent just how special this team could be.
I can distinctly remember writing when they went to San Antonio. Went to San Antonio, and Larry had 31 in the first half, on 11 for 11. And what can I say? And it was a show. It was a show. And I remember writing, is this what it was like in the old days of the Wild West when the Annie Oakley or someone would come to town? You know, they would have the posters around town, or the circus coming to town. This is what it was like. It was not an athletic event. It was an event for the on the road. Everywhere you went, when they got off the bus, there were autograph seekers. You went to the hotel, there were autograph seekers. When they went to practice, there were people, autograph seekers. There were people everywhere they went. They were the first team to attract this kind of attention. We called these people on the road the Green People, and the Celtics had a national following. Now, later on, this would be the Bulls would become that team, and to a lesser degree, the Lakers. But the Bulls would become that team under Michael. But believe me, Larry got there first, and the Celtics got there first and set the table for that kind of national acclaim. There is no question that everywhere they went, it was not just they were in town to play an NBA basketball game. It was a big social event. The team went 37-1 in the Garden and 3-0 in Hartford. The only loss was to the Trail Blazers in early December, a game in which they were trailing the whole game and suddenly took a lead in the third period, finally. At which point, the way things had been going, you expected they would continue. And the lead lasted 15 seconds. And one of those flying burrito brothers, or we used to call them Steve Coulter or Jerome Kersey, the late Jerome Kersey, one of those guys went down there and scored right away. And they went up winning by 15 points. That was it. That was the only loss of the year at home. Down the stretch, it was once they kicked into gear in January and in February. And from that point on, you expect them to win every game. Literally and truly, I expected them to win every game. And they won the last, 13 home games by an average of 16 points a game. 16 points to home games by average of 13 points a game, but there were no games contested in the last month and a half at home. Seriously, they were just so dominant. And that continued. It continued in the playoffs. They never lost a game at home in the playoffs that year, and in fact got up 2-0 in every series. So that naturally as a result, it was spectacular. I mean, and the crowds. They really were a six man. They really were Bird particularly orchestrated. He should play with a baton in one hand because he totally orchestrated that crowd. The way he used a 3-point shot as a psychological weapon in a way that people had not done up to that point. You know, we were still feeling our way around a 3-point shot. Remember, it's only the seventh year of its existence, and still there were teams that weren't comfortable about how much they should take and what emphasis there should be on it. Never dreaming the way the league would evolve as it is today, but Larry used that 3-point shot to tease and orchestrate the crowd. He did everything, but everything he did, you could tell, was for the crowd as well as for his team and his teammates. Yeah, they were amazingly good at home. And they kept it going, you know, well into the 86-87. And when it got up to like 88-1 or 89-1, oh, yeah, it kept going and going and going and going and going. Because it was a year and a half or even two-thirds of extraordinary dominance. To that point in time, the league hadn't seen anything like that since the early 50s when the home court advantage was frighteningly dominant due to intimidated referees. And frankly, among other things, and crazy buildings like in Syracuse where the crowd was really right on people, you know. And you had to go back and find teams like the old Lakers or the old Nats who would have these great home records. I mean, prior to this 40-1 that the Celtics put up, usually you would find, I think, that the best home records would be about 35-6, 34-7, year in, year out. That would be the peak of it. The league hadn't seen nothing like this in the memory of anyone, you know, that was still in the league. You'd have to have gone back to, you know, Bob Cousy, remember, because he was playing, and that's about it, because everybody else had never seen anything like this. And the home loss for Portland, the young athletes just had a better night. I mean, I don't remember much more than the fact that we were oohing and aahing. We, Dan Shaughnessy, myself, and the other guys at the press table, this was a young, as I said, they had a nickname, Flying Burrito Brothers. That's what they called it. It was Steve Coulter, who was a very quick 6-1 or 2 guard, and the young Jerome Kersey was a real, you know, aggressive, very exciting 6-7 forward, and they were high flyers, and they were athletic. And Clyde Drexler was in his prime and having a good night, I am sure. And they just downplayed them, you know. Nobody's perfect. They were damn good, but not perfect. And that night they just got beat. But once again, they didn't give up. They were down fairly big. They came back, took the lead, And that was it. One possession. I know it was one possession. So they flipped the lead. The other guys went down the court. Boom. Scored. And that was it. And they stretched it out, one by 15. So they had a bad night. They had one night, one little blemish on the, you know, on the record. That was it. One night. In December. So imagine how many, I don't know what the numbers were, how many from that point on they won the rest of the season, you know. And then, of course, in Hartford, there was no competition in Hartford either. There was no, you know. Larry Bird at this point is, he turned 30 in December of 86. So he turned 29 as the season progressed. On December 7th, 1985, he turns 29. So this is now the culmination. He's conquered elbows and backs, and he did have some back issues. He did have elbows issues, but they were, you know, they were cured, cleared up. And he's now in his third straight year. He could have won another MVP, but for now, he's the best player in the league right now. He's the best player in the league. If he's not, it's Magic, and they can have that argument between themselves. But at that point, I think you had to say he was. Magic would later, you know, stay healthier longer. Okay, fine. But at this point in time, Larry Bird's best player in the league. Michael's getting his feet wet. Michael's coming along, but he's not there yet. Okay, it's Larry Bird's world. The whole game was he mastered the game. He literally mastered the game. Mastered the game to the point, though, this is where he began amusing himself, I think, to keep himself interested. Now, this is my theory alone. I mean, my theory, I can't prove anything. But I do believe that the game got almost too easy for him. So he was manufacturing little challenges for himself. This is the year he starts shooting left hand more and more, culminating in the game in Portland, when he has the 47-point game in which he has the game-tying basket to go into overtime, the game-winning turnaround to win the game with 3 seconds to go in his overtime, and, oh, by the way, 7 left-hand baskets. Some of them are necessary. Some of them aren't. And this culminates later on the next year against the Pistons when he makes a 15-foot left-hand bank shot in Game 7 against the Pistons in 87, which he didn't have to take either. This is the phase Larry had now entered into amusing Larry Bird as well as winning the game. That's how good he got. That's how great he was. His shooting was perfect. His passing was superb. His team defense was fantastic. It's the best, you know. It's the best forward play that's ever been seen, and by anybody. It was wonderful, and naturally sets the tone. Meanwhile, Kevin McHale is this ridiculously unstoppable force in the low post. Robert Parrish is this, you know, if he's the third best player on the team, you can argue that he would have been the best player in the history of about 10 other teams, and I'll make that argument. And he's got it all going. You know, every year he's relentlessly shooting 54% from the floor. He's the only question is how many shots is he going to get? Nothing changed for like 12 years in a row. He shot between 51 and like 58%, and just a matter of how many shots he got, how many points he averaged, because he was going to make the shots that he took. He's playing great, and he's getting more and more acclimated, and they're doing more. I mean, Larry and Robert, you talk about pick and roll duos. Oh, you kidding me? You know. I mean, who's better than that today? You know, there's good ones, but they're not better than Larry Bird and Robert Parrish, pick and roll. They got it. And then DJ, who was a unique force, a unique player, a guard. Unlike no one with that particular style of DJs have we seen. And Danny is the best pure athlete of the bunch, you know, doing Danny's thing. Danny never gave up a cheap basket in his life. He was tremendous on the fast break. He was a three-point shooter. You know, he's quick, guard guys. I mean, Danny was a terrific player. And he's coming into his own. Meanwhile, you got this bench with Walton, Scott Wedman. By the way, we mentioned that Kevin got hurt and missed like 12 games and surrounding the All-Star game, which he played in, oddly. Wedman starts. Didn't miss anybody. And then Seasting, who down the stretch shoots 64% from the floor in his final 17 games. 98% of them are foul line jump shots. He never makes a layup, to the point where my colleague Lee Montville jokes that if Seasting had an autobiography, the title should be "I've Never Been to the Paint." But he's relentless, and this is exactly what he was brought on to do. And they got, and when I needed the help from Rick Carlisle, the rookie Rick Carlisle in L.A. on a Sunday afternoon when things were bogged down, he comes off and shoots 5 for 7. I can still see a nice corner jumper, a big one in the corner. I got him. And David Thirdkill is defending people. And Sam Vincent's sticking his nose in there every once in a while. It's a pretty good team.
And Greg Kite.
Greg Kite, who was a great pick setter, a good rebounder, a great team guy. And I used to kid, though, that there should be a dollar fine for anybody who throws him the ball, and you get 50 cents back if he happens to put it in the basket. Offense was not his forte.
A big part of why the 86 Celtics were different from the previous season was the contribution off the bench of a healthy Bill Walton.
Walton, this is something, there's no way, it's looking back on it 30 years later, what rational explanation is there for the fact that he played in 80 games, a career high, didn't miss a game, the two he missed during the regular season, he did not miss due to his feet or ankles, which had been the problem, and that he was able to give them this kind of a season. And so there's no explanation for it, but it happened. Not only that, he made every two-a-day in the training camp. He was a bonus, other than opening night when he declared himself to be a disgrace to basketball, quote-unquote, in that horrible loss to the Nets. There were very few nights when he wasn't a tremendous asset coming off the bench, and that's why but how do you explain he and Bird? Well, how about this? Every time he would come in the game, you could bet that within a few possessions, there would be a give and go. I mean, an old-fashioned give and go. You say, well, why can't anybody stop it? Everybody knew it was coming. They could vary the timing on it somehow. They had a telepathy that was, that was unstoppable. And sometimes the pass would be over the shoulder as Larry goes to the other side. Sometimes it would be between the legs or behind the back or right hand, left hand, this angle, that hand. I mean, always delivered properly, perfectly, to Bird. It was one of the great weapons in the history of the league. Everybody knew it was coming. It was like the Lombardi power sweep. Nobody could stop it. And of course, remember, now we're talking about Bill Walton. If he's not the greatest passing center of all time, he's in the top five, all right? I mean, who knows, There are great centers. Bob, Johnny Kerr, Tom Boerwinkel was a great passing center. Duncan's a great passing center. But I don't think any of them are any better than Walton was. Walton was the greatest passing center of his time, that's for sure. So he's playing with the smartest forward who ever lived and the best forward, Larry Bird. He changed games in a way that have not been changed before or since. Other six men came in, and they were either guard forward or, in McHale's case, forward center. And Kevin wasn't that kind of a creative player. I mean, Kevin's passing came very late in his career. Did Kevin finally, stop being the black hole that they used to kid him about being very late? Walton was the polar opposite. And he blocked shots. He rebounded. Oh, his rebounding technique. Let's talk about that. He doesn't get enough credit for being remembered as the incredible rebounder that he was. His timing was as good as anyone. Certainly, I will say, we had Bill Russell in his town, so I'm not going to say he's better than anybody else. But other than Russell, I never saw anyone better timing. What he could do is that on a defensive rebound, his timing was such that he could take the ball off the rim as if sweeping crumbs off the table at the precise moment when it may very well have been goaltending, but it was so borderline it wasn't going to get called. The timing was so perfect. And then, of course, turning to look for the outlet before he even hits the floor and thinking outlet pass. And of course, Larry's reading this, and they all learned to read it because they all knew what it meant to have him in the game. So that aspect alone is rebounding. And he had some games where he was just an utter machine. A game night in Houston, we had 16 rebounds. I remember that game specifically where I'm just going, oh, my God, this is just, it's a treasure. It's a beautiful thing to watch. He was in the game, and another game people remember very vividly was against the Lakers in January when he comes in and blocks. He sends one on Kareem back to the, half court or something. And you can imagine what that did for the crowd. And he wound up having a big night. They romped that night. That was the night. There was when he was on, it was almost unfair. It was crazy.
Rightfully so. The 86 Celtics were always known as a confident bunch. This tone was set by their leader, Larry Bird. A legendary story from this season in Bird's career was his entry into the three-point shootout at NBA All-Star Weekend.
Speaking of trash talking, as we often do with this team, this was Larry Bird feeling his oats in a magnificent way. He's in Dallas, and that's the first three-point contest. And Larry, by the way, one of the participants was Leon Wood, who still remains an NBA referee. So, a little subplot there. Larry does, in fact, announce to the team, to the group, which one of you guys is finishing second. And then goes out and dominates this thing. And in a way that people, just fueled that growing legend of his, which included the sight of the two balls in the air at once. Now, we see that now. you know, the guys as the three-point perfection has taken place, but this was all new to the world. Larry would shoot it, and before the other one even hit the rim, he's got the other one in the air, and he hit like 11 in a row at one point, including the money basket, you know, with the white and blue and all. And all these numbers have been exceeded since then. But at that point in time, because it was Larry Bird, because it was known that he had announced this the declaration that he was going to finish second, it was great. And then after the game, they asked Larry, you know, it was like $10,000, something like that. You know, Larry, what are you going to do with the money? He says, it's going to go to the Larry Bird Fund. That was the coup at the end of the day with Larry.
Following the All-Star game, and just as they did on opening night, the Celtics lost to a team they should have beat.
By that point, after they lost this game in Sacramento, after the first game in the All-Star break, which was a stunner, that was like the last, I don't know. That kind of like was erasing the blackboard from that point on. They kick in by playing some of the best basketball the world had ever seen and has ever seen. They got so good, and they just got good, and they got better and better. Walton was riding high, playing great, coming off the bench, doing his thing. Danny was starting to become more and more a part of the mix. Larry, once again, gee, it started with Bird. What a shock. Larry gets on one of the great hot streaks of his career. That's saying a lot with Larry Bird. Among other things, Larry gets on a roll on three-pointers where he goes 23 for 32 in one stretch on threes, okay, over a six-game period, something like that. Larry gets on a roll. They go to Texas. He throws in 50 in defeat in Dallas. They lose a one-point game. Danny, get up on Brad Davis. Don't let him shoot a three. He didn't. He did. They lost. Larry wasted 50. They go to the next two places in Texas. Larry comes away from the Texas trip having shot 65% and averaging 38 points a game. They win in San Antonio and Houston. And they're just suddenly, they're giving nothing away. They gave games away, see, a few that year. They even gave one away in New Jersey. This team, had it been a goal, would have been the team to win 70 first. There's no question in my mind they win 70 that year if that had been a goal. They did fool around a little bit. They didn't, you know, unlike 07-08, the hardest playing Celtic team ever, they didn't give any games away. That 07-08 team, not one. But these guys did. I don't know. Well, they didn't give too many away down in the second half of the year. And they were playing so well, it was just, it was a pleasure to the point where I remember writing and saying, they have rendered meaningless the concept of the meaningless game. Every game was a delight. It was a spectator treat. It was a treasure. They go to San Antonio, for example. And Larry casually shoots 11 for 11 in the first half. And that's 31 points at the half. And they win in this romp. And I remember thinking that they're no longer just a basketball team. They're like it's the circus has come to town. Like Annie Oakley has come to the Old West to the town to put on an exhibition of shooting. Their every stop was an event. And they were just entertaining America. But their road games were absolutely, it's what they were doing. And of course, it goes without saying they were entertaining the people in Boston. You could not want to see a game. You had to watch every game. There were people out there, I know they are, they're out there. I got to tape every game. I'll never see anything like this again. No, you won't, and we haven't. I mean, this is the best basketball that Boston and the NBA has ever seen, in my opinion, is that team as it started.
A finals rematch against the Lakers seemed inevitable all year long. However, a miraculous game-winning shot from Ralph Sampson sent the Houston Rockets to Boston in 1986.
There is no question that people were disappointed not to see the purple and gold show up again. That people wanted to exact revenge. Yes, no question. There was no great respect. Remember, the Rockets had interfered once before in 81. Well, they got there by beating the Lakers when they weren't supposed to do so, and that turned out to be a harder, more rugged six games than people thought. Give them full credit, but that resulted in Bird's first championship. This time, yeah, people didn't want to see the Rockets; they wanted to see the Lakers, and people naturally made an assumption it was going to be a blowout series, and it turned out to be a more competitive series than people thought. Give the Rockets, give them full credit for although, as I recall, I did predict the Celtics in six, but I don't think most fans thought that. I'm sure that I would rather have seen the Lakers just for the historical impact and just for the social impact and the whole fun of it. The Lakers-Celtics series, the Lakers and Celtics arguably at that point were the best, certainly the best rivalry in basketball, no question, and one of the handful of premier rivalries in all of sports. There's no question. People, oh yeah, we wanted to see the Lakers. We wanted to, you know, Kareem and Magic and Worthy. Oh no, they were part of the landscape. Definitely wanted them, and so it was a letdown. The pattern continued. The Celtics win 1-2, and at home, with no great difficulty, had been the case with the exception of Game 2 against the. You know, they never looked back in terms of that after Game 2, after the 63-point game. In the next three series, they got up very easily 1-2 at home. Game 3 down there, I don't honestly remember much about Game 3 down there. I don't. But I remember Game 4. I remember writing this one. I said, it's the best NBA Finals game of the last 10 years. It was an epic game. They played great. They, being the Rockets, kept them hung in, played great. Made the Celtics play a high level of ball. The big determining thing in that game was that Casey Jones made a fateful decision for the first time in the entire season. He elected to have Bill Walton finish the game of a contested game rather than Robert Parrish. What gut feeling whim he had, I don't recall, but it was a perfect decision because Walton came in and made big plays, including an offensive rebound and a beautiful reverse putback. And I believe there's a defensive play in there too. And that's the only time that happened. So they win game four and they're up 3-1. And then game five, oh, it was crazy. And that's a game in which there was a fight. Ralph Sampson got into a fight, which involved A, Jerry Seasting, and B, Dennis Johnson. And people got involved, and there was a lot of bitter feeling, and the Celtics were beaten on the boards. That's the other thing. The Celtics were getting surrendering the boards, and they got beat. And now they got to come home. And, you know, people were a little antsy because of the nature of the way they had lost. Nobody else had done that to them the way the Rockets had, to beat them on the boards so badly. But there was one person who wasn't worried at all, and that was number 33. And Larry Bird was sitting home in Brookline watching television with his then-girlfriend, now wife, Dinah, and saw the television coverage of the Rockets arriving in Boston and took one look at Ralph and said, "We don't have to worry about him. He's out of this." And seriously, and Ralph did, in fact, lay a big egg on Sunday that day. And Larry also, I remember, told... Larry was a master of using the media to get to the fans. And this is before social media. Interesting to see what Larry would have done with social media, if anything. But there was no social media. We were the legitimate conduit. And I remember him on that Saturday afternoon of practice saying that we're not going to have... We need rebounds. We're going to get rebounds. We need this. We're going to get that. We're going to be fine. Larry Bird assured the world, we're going to be fine. What did we get on that Sunday afternoon? We got what Larry Bird maintains to this day was the game in which he was, and I quote him, most prepared ever to play. Now, that's an interesting statement that he would phrase it in that way. You figure, when was he ever not prepared, you know, or what degree of preparedness, you know, could Larry Bird have? Well, that's what he said. All I know is this. Prepared to whatever degree he says he was, it was one of the greatest individual performances. I think it may have been his greatest game. The numbers won't show it. It was a very nice routine triple-double, 29, 11, 12, something like that. Doesn't begin. He got a jump ball against Olajuwon. Now, he can't do that, but he did it, okay? He was omnipresent defensively. He anticipated where they wanted the ball. He was like a one-man, he was a one-man zone, quite frankly. He was going crazy, but he was everywhere. And he just totally dominated the game in every way. And of course, the artistic highlight was when he dribbles from the right on the right box, zigzag dribbles out to the corner to turn around and hit a three and go, you know, and when they were pouring it on in the second half, you know, that was just crazy. And it was one of the, it was this great. I think it was a fantastic performance by Bird, and they win the game easily. And this turned out to be, unfortunately, his final championship. That winning that championship, now that's third one in the Bird era. It's the third one since '81. He's evened himself up with Magic at 3-3, by the way, at this point, which is very important to him, very important. And the future looked fantastic. Now, were we foolish enough to think that the Bill Walton thing would maintain itself for another year? Yeah, probably. You know, and we all know what happened. He got hurt riding an exercise bike, played 10 games the next year, retired, you know, after the 87 finals, having made no contribution. And now we have to look back and say what a blessing it was to have him for that year. Of course it was. The world was rosy. The Celtics were on top. Bird was 29. McHale, you know, was lots left. Robert wasn't going anywhere. DJ had plenty left. Danny was just getting some rolling. Yeah, let's talk about Danny for a second. Yeah, I mean, you can throw this any way you want, but one of the things, got to go back to one of the things that subplots in game two against the Jordan game. The big development for the Boston Celtics in the Jordan 63-point game was Danny Ainge having 24 points coming off the bench, and most of them in the second half and overtimes. Without that contribution, they don't win. And that, from that moment on, Danny Ainge took his place with the other four as an equal. I don't think there was ever anyone thinking of him as anything more than the fifth, you know, wheel. And all of a sudden now they've got, you know, he would later culminate becoming an all-star. And, you know, and that's when it really started. So didn't get down there. That was a key game for Danny. It was the world was theirs then. They were the number one. And what a great year, of course. This is, we don't know what's coming up for us in October of 86 in Shea Stadium. We don't know what's coming up there. But we're coming out of a Super Bowl that was very, 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 very disappointing, obviously. What a time. You know, we've got three teams playing for a championship in one year in Boston. But most of all, you know, the Celtics.
As history played out, the 1986 championship would be the last of the Larry Bird era, as tragic moments would shape the future of the Celtics for years to come.
The Celtics are sitting as the champions, and they have the number two pick in the draft with a couple of enticing possibilities, because Jan Volka, as the general manager, has made a fantastic trade the year before by trading Gerald Henderson to the Seattle Sonics for what turned out to be for their pick in 1986, and the Sonics cooperated by going in the tank and winding up giving them the second pick in the draft. And it's pretty evident that the pick is going to be either Brad Daugherty or from North Carolina or Lynn Bias of Maryland. The Cavaliers get Daugherty, and Celtics take Bias. And so for 12 hours, it's a wonderful thing. I had seen Lynn Bias. I was one of the few people in Boston that could truthfully say I had seen him in person. I was actually present at a game in Cameron Indoor Stadium when he dropped 40 on Duke. And twice subsequently, Mike Krzyzewski has told me that the two greatest opponents he has ever faced at Duke were Michael Jordan and Lynn Bias. He would have been the worthy kind of second-tier perennial All-Star. It wasn't going to be Bird, Magic, or Michael, you know, LeBron, Duncan, that. But the next level, that next level. And the next level goes the All-Star game, McHale level, you know. And that he would have, how it would have unfolded, we'll never know. But, yes, it would have been an incredible addition to the cast. Bird was excited about it. Bird said he was going to come to camp early, work with him. It was dream come true. It was too good to be true. It was fantastic. And of course, you know, that's a whole other story. Everyone has a story. It's one of those events. It's one of those incidents where everyone has a story. My story is that I was leaving to go to the office sometime in the 9 to 10 o'clock a.m. range on that day after the draft. And my son, who was then 16, ran out of the house, said, Dad, Lynn Bias is dead. He'd heard it on the radio, seen it on TV, whatever. What? And I drove right to the garden instead. And, you know, we started piecing together the story. Now, I had been part of WEEI's radio coverage the day before, as well as writing for The Globe. And I was sitting with Glenn Ordway doing an interview with Lynn Bias then the night before. You know, late in the afternoon, he had flown up after the draft. Early in the day, he and his father flew up from D.C. They were taken to the, what do we do it, at the garden, whatever. And I can still see him with a Celtic hat on, you know, in a gray suit, newly purchased suit, and beaming, great smile. And, you know, father beaming and interviewing him. And then, you know, see you later. He was on his way to, you know, celebrate, I guess. And whatever happened, happened. And, it was just totally stunning. And, you know, one of the most disturbing athletic stories in the history of Boston, I think is probably the best way to put it. At that point, the Celtics looked, and I won't say untouchable, but awfully good. There's no reason to think they weren't going to be back in 87, except the X factor of Walton's precarious health. But he had been so healthy, and everything looked so good at that point. And at that point, he was around 30, I guess. And he, you know, there's no reason to think he wouldn't be back, but it didn't. Right away, it went bad. And the whole thing, suddenly next year, you're trying to defend with Fred Roberts and Darren Day as primary bench guys as well. And there were injuries, and, you know, Larry got himself in this phenomenal shape in the offseason because he didn't want to get hurt anymore, and he wound up getting hurt anyway. Larry's, for the rest of his career, was always, you know, is he healthy? Is he practicing? Is he not practicing? He had some great years and was still the best player in the league, and, you know, probably in 87, 88. But we all remember the shootout with Dominique and all that. But yes, I thought the Celtics were set up, and in fact, go back to the finals the next year. Whole other matter, though, was all on the shoulders of the starting five. The minutes were extraordinary. And in 87, that was really the big theme that we harped upon the whole playoffs was, how can they keep up these minutes? And so even like four of them were averaging 40 minutes a game. And it was just too much. The Lakers got better. The Lakers picked up Michael Thompson. They reloaded. They didn't break up their team. They held it together, and they made the right decision, as we know. But, yeah, so the Celtics are still very good in 87. They're still very good in 88. But now the Pistons have come on, you know. And, you know, lose a tough six-game series in 88 after the shootout to Dominique. But it was still a good era. Still killing people at home, by the way. 86-87, they didn't lose too many at home either. The big issue was always going to be how are we going to transition after the big three? And how are you going to handle that? And Dave Gavitt becomes the CEO in 90 and is confronted with this. And as it turned out, his response to it was, I'm not going to do anything. And maybe he thought about it. And maybe there were recurrent rumors about trading McHale. And Dallas was one big one at one point. There was never an issue about Robert. There was never an issue about Larry. It was always about Kevin and the possibility of trading Kevin McHale. That was bandied about. And how seriously any of them ever were and how close to fruition any of those deals ever were, I don't know. But he's the only one. Obviously, Larry Bird was Larry Bird. What happened with Larry Bird was it all became about injury. You know, the wrenching of the heels, the double in wrenching of the heels that night in Cleveland. I'll never forget it. I saw, you know, you saw it and you didn't believe it. What happened? How do you do this, you know? And that year was gone. Literally, played six games. You know, Jimmy Rogers, poor Jimmy, inherits the team from KC after KC resigns after the 87-88 season. And Jimmy inherits a totally different team because of no Larry. But then they had a little renaissance, you know, and there was in 1991, they start the season, they're 27-5. Kevin Gambles, that is his forward, you know, with this fifth man. And Kevin still got it. Larry got hurt. I still remember early January. This was like always a bad sign when Dave Gavitt wanted to have a talk to us before a game. Anytime Dave Gavitt wanted to have a press conference before a game, you knew it wasn't good, and it would probably involve Larry, and it did. And he's telling us about Larry, and you know, and so that season. But just remember how the 89-90 season ended with losing to the Knicks in five. You know, Larry missing a dunk in that final game. I can remember driving baseline and missing that dunk. But that's when after they scored 157 points in game one, franchise record in the playoffs. Jim Paxson, remember that? And they had their moments after that. They had moments, you know, but the last great moment was going 27-5 to start that one season. And then from that point on, they could be good. They could win 50. And right up to Larry's last season, you know, Larry's last season in 92. They lose a 7 to Cleveland. And, you know, and I kind of figured that was his last game, but didn't know for sure. But, So anyway, the Celtics, the issue was about the big three. And the first of two such issues that the Celtics would face with a big three. so-called. And they did nothing. And so they went one by one. Larry went after 92, and Kevin went after 93, and then eventually Robert. And Robert wasn't done. Robert has a second life, Robert a third life, I guess, if you call a second life the Celtics. He winds up in Chicago, and he winds up in Charlotte. And has his, plays the most games of anybody in the history of the league. Robert was a phenomenon. Robert was wonderful. The consistency of Robert Parrish in the bulk of his career is one of the great stat lines to look at. And take a look at it someday, anybody. Go look at it. The year after year, that 50% plus shooting every single year. And we know how many of those shots were that devastating turnaround. And where his momentum sometimes would literally carry him off the court, right into the bench. It was an amazing shot.
The fortune of the Boston Celtics certainly changed in the late 80s into the early 90s, but also there were changes around the NBA.
The NBA, look, all sports choose to expand, and in so doing, run the risk of diluting their product. There's no question about that. No sport's immune. The NBA, for a lot of us, was at its zenith in the 80s, and yet if you look back, and it was true, there was great players. If you look back, only four teams won the championships in the 80s. The Lakers, the Celtics, the 76ers, and the Pistons. But one of the things I like to do to pour out, you know, how expansion has diluted everything is that I like to give there's a list of like 12 or 15 names that I put down on paper. And those names include Kevin McHale, Bill Walton, James Worthy, Bobby Jones, Vinnie Johnson, Dennis Rodman, and there's some pretty, Michael Thompson, Jamal Wilkes, and I say to somebody, well, what do these names have in common? And they dance around it. They don't get it exactly right. Each of those people came off the bench in a regular capacity at some time or another for a full season, at least one, for each of the four teams that won the championships in the 80s. And I think that team together could have beaten any of the Bulls teams. Now, I may be wrong about that, but they could play. That team together would win a minimum of 55 games, probably win 60. And even with the backcourt, not the greatest, but not bad. I mean, your backcourt would be Danny, Vinnie Johnson, Michael Cooper. I can live with that. And one of his first openers. So, point being, who today can afford to bring all-stars off benches? I mean, Bobby Jones regularly came off the bench because they could afford to do it. McHale came off the bench because the Celtics could afford to do it. The Lakers had these people coming off the bench because they could afford to do it. You can't afford to do that today. Nobody's got guys like that coming off the bench. And we have all these teams. They just so in that sense, there was more of a consolidation of talent than there is today. There's still a lot of great players. I mean, we're in another good era now where we're really, you know, and it looks like there's the 1 over 182 return on opening night of the NBA is that a lot of rookies made it, had a pretty good night. Conceding my obvious Boston-centric viewpoint, I hate the word bias, it's not what it is. Yes, I have to allow that naturally I'm going to be in favor in their looking favorably upon them. But I honestly believe it's the best team of all time for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that Bill Walton was a force coming off the bench, unlike any other force that has ever come off a bench. It was a different kind of a six-man force. And we saw what that partnership with Bird did to win games night after night after night after night. Secondly, when you're matching up against the other great teams in history that would be in this discussion, starting with the Bulls, either the Horace Grant power forward Bulls or the Dennis Rodman power forward Bulls, you know, starting with those Bulls, the great question I like to throw back at people who advocate those teams is, yeah, who's going to guard McHale? Don't tell me Rodman could not guard McHale. That's not impossible. So let's just forget that. Who's going to guard McHale? McHale is another trump card. They got two trump cards. I didn't even mention Larry. But Larry, there were guys that actually could guard Larry to a degree, but McHale, no. So they could beat you either any way you want. The 85-86 Celtics could run you out of the building. They could half court you out of the building. The defensive concepts were different then. Okay, the defense is more concentrated now. The defense is more constant now. I grant you that. the league in those days, you picked your spots. You said, we're going to turn it on right now. We're going to stop them right here and now, next four, five, six possessions, or next 4 or 5 minutes, and we're going to win the game. And then you go back to the give two, get two thing. The NBA was like that. I concede that. It's not like that now. They could play defense, though, as well as any team can play defense today. And it had to, I mean, they had, well, they could go. And that team just had components. I mean, Jerry Seastin comes off the bench and shoots 64% the last 17 games of the year. I mean, on outside shots. I mean, that's not bad. Scott Wedman was a former All-Star. That's not bad. I just don't have any fears about this team playing any team that's ever been. I would take them over anyway.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode with Bob Ryan. If you've missed previous episodes of the 86 Celtics podcast, just head over to csnne.com/podcast or subscribe on iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher, or Google Play. Look for new episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I am Abby Chin, and we will see you next time on the 86 Celtics Interviews.